The What's the Crack podcast with Anthony Martin.
Listen in live weekly on Brighton's Radio Reverb.
See whatsthecrack.co.uk and radioreverb.com for showtimes.
Back in the late 70s, a band formed in Belfast whose debut album Inflammable Material would go on to be the first independent labelled album to chart in the UK. They were deemed pioneers of punk, and their song Alternative Ulster is considered by many as one of the greatest Irish songs ever. Their new album No Going Back was released in 2014 and it received critical acclaim. The band are now touring across Europe and they play Concord 2 in Brighton next Monday night, the 7th of December. On the phone from Stiff Little Fingers, I have Jake Burns. Hello, Jake.
Hey, Anthony, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Fine, thank you. It's fine.
How's your tour going at the moment? You're doing a tour for your latest album at the moment. How's that going?
Yeah, it's going well. Audiences are good. We're having a lot of fun. So, you know, so the weather actually has been pretty reasonable as well, which is always important on these when you're doing a bus tour, you know. But, of course, the minute I say that, I look out the window and it's just started snowing. So,
Well, I suppose it's going to get a little bit worse, I'm afraid, next week when you come to Britain, because you're playing in Brighton next Monday evening.
We are, yeah. Last night of the tour should be a lot of fun. I mean, it's always a great show down there anyway. Concord's always a very welcoming venue, so we look forward to playing. And I didn't think we were going to get the chance this year, so it suddenly popped up right at the end, which was fantastic.
Yeah. And what can fans expect, I guess, from the Brighton gig? What kind of songs are you going to be playing or dipping into?
Well, the same as we always try and do. I mean, I know you mentioned earlier that obviously we've got an album that just came out last year. I've never been comfortable treating a tour as you know, like a walk-in ad for your latest record. I mean, I think, you know, we always try and go back through the band's career, particularly a band like ourselves that have been kicking around for so long, you know. There's a lot to get through, which invariably means you end up leaving out something that somebody wants to hear, but, you know, hopefully by doing that you put in something somebody else wants to hear, you know. It's kind of a balancing act at this stage here of the game, you know.
You mentioned about the starting of the band. The band started kind of back in 1977, back in
That's
Belfast.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, as a punk rock band. What was the background to the origin of that?
Well, I mean, basically, we were all, apart from Ali, the original four members all went to the same school together. So we were kind of school friends. And, yeah, we just started, you know, we learned to play instruments, not necessarily all of us together, but myself and Brian started playing at roughly the same time. He was the original drummer. And, you know, it was just something that we did for fun, really. And, you know, we drifted through various school bands. And when we arrived at Stiff Little Fingers, I mean, one of the main reasons we actually started looking for gigs, really, was the fact that we realized that a lot of the bands that we liked were probably never going to come and play in Belfast, obviously mainly because of the situation there at the time. Also, you know, it was difficult for local bands to get gigs. The whole punk rock thing seemed to provide a sort of do-it-yourself impetus that hadn't been there before. Okay. So, you know, bands like ourselves and the Outcasts and Rudy were effectively going out and finding these places to play. Yeah. So it was kind of fun to do. Unfortunately, our bass player at the time, Gordon Blair, decided he didn't want to play in a rock band. He quit, but, you know, his loss was definitely our gain when we found Ali, you know. So.
Yeah. How quickly did it take off for the band then in Belfast?
Looking back on it, it was very fast. I mean, at the time, it seemed like everything was taking an age to happen. But, you know, when you look back on it, you know, we went from forming the band around April 77 to having the first single out in March 78 to being on a national tour with the Tom Robinson Band by late August and recording 78 and recording the first album. November, December 78. So, and by 79, we were in the charts, you know. So it was very, very quick.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the time, it just all seemed, everything seemed to be taking forever. But then that's how you view things when you're young, you know. We'll be right back.
last year as well, you released your first album in quite a while, your 10th studio album, No Going Back. It did very well, actually. Went to number one in the UK rock charts. And it was...
It did, yeah.
Was that a relief, or...?
Yeah, we should... No, it's not so much a relief. It was kind of funny. I mean, obviously, the charts have changed since I was a boy. Yeah. They now divide them up into, you know, each subdivision of the type of music and stuff. I mean, yes, it's one of those weird things. It was nice to sort of think that after all those years, we got a number one record, but, you know, it didn't really mean much beyond us. I mean, like I said, we actually thought it was funny. I mean, we were in Canada at the time when we got the news. Mm. And just to give you an idea of where our priorities are, I live in America now, so, you know, going to Canada is classed as you incur roaming charges on your phone. Yeah. unless you pay for them, you know, unless you pay in advance. Yeah. But we were only doing two shows in Canada. So I actually said to my wife, like, you know, for the sake of, like, I'm going to be in Canada for 3 days, you know, just text me, for those 3 days. And if there's anything you really need, call me. I said, but in the main, don't bother calling because it costs a damn fortune. It's not worth it. So she was like, yeah, okay, fine. And literally 2 minutes later, my phone started to ring. And obviously I could see from the ident that it was my wife. Hmm. And I sort of picked up the phone. I was literally just about to start, almost like start yelling. Going, didn't I tell you just 2 seconds ago not to phone me? And she sort of cut me off mid-sentence and said, number one. I went, I'm sorry, we're what? She said, your album's number one in the UK. And I went, well, that's brilliant. But get off the phone. This is costing a fortune.
So I like your priorities there. That was good.
Well, absolutely. You know.
And that album as well. It was crowdfunded on Pledge Music. Did that take a lot of pressure off you as a band in terms of, you know, being more in control, do you think?
It did, and it didn't. I mean, to be honest with you, Anthony, it kind of put more pressure on us initially. Mm. I mean, for a number of reasons. One, you know, we spent our entire career, with the exception of the first album, being sort of, if you like, in the bosom of the record companies, you know. So we were with Chrysalis, and then we were with EMI, and they're both, you know, they're both major labels. And obviously we could have gone back to any of, you know, those people and said, we'd like to make a record. And we've always made money for them, so in general, that's their bottom line. They don't really care. I mean, some people, that's unfair. Some people that work for record labels do care very deeply whether it's a good record or not. But the bottom line is, if you're making money for the company, then you're generally welcomed back. And if you're not, well, you know, unless you're the boss's pet project, you're not, you know. So we knew we could go back. But when we actually spoke to some folks at EMI, they were kind of downhearted. Not so much about bringing the band, you know, putting another record out for the band. It was more that they didn't see their role in the music industry anymore. I mean, with the rise, you know, when you initially look for a record deal, what you're looking for is for somebody to put your record in record shops. Well, there weren't any, and there aren't any, you know, apart from specialist stores these days. You know, the internet and Amazon in particular have kind of, and iTunes have put head to that. And so they were like, you know, well, yeah, I mean, you know, obviously you can make a record here if you want, but why would you want to? You can do it yourselves. And so we started thinking along those lines. And it was actually our managers who came up with the idea of doing it through Pledge Music.
Yeah.
And, you know, initially we were a bit hesitant because we were a bit like, well, aren't we asking them to buy something they haven't heard? And they said, well, yeah, but it's a bit like buying something on pre-release if you think about it.
Yeah,
you know, it's just like, you know, the album will be out next, you know, May, but you can order it now. It's kind of a bit like that, you know. So we thought, yeah, okay, I guess that makes sense. And then one of them said something that sort of made my blood run cold. He said, of course, the downside to this is, you know, if we go to EMI and they say they're not interested, we can then go to Sony and we can go to Warner's and we can keep going until eventually somebody says yes. He said, the thing about this is you're basically going straight to your own audience and saying, we're thinking of making a new record. Would you like to buy it? He said, if they say no, you're screwed. If your audience don't want it, then, what's the point in making it? There was a freedom that came with it, but there was also that worry. And, you know, but we really didn't need to worry. I mean, we launched the Pledge campaign, and I think we'd reached the target. We set it up to run for, I think, 3 months, and we reached the target in under 12 hours, which was just incredible.
Wow.
So, you know, then we realized that there was obviously a demand for it. But then, of course, you go into the studio and you've got the extra then you've got the extra pressure of, well, the audience have already bought this, and this isn't, you know, this isn't EMI's money we're spending here. You know, this is our audience's money, and they've already bought this record, so we better make sure we make a damn good record, you know.
They built the city, sharp as flint that could make you cry. Hold on to it, hold on to it. It's a dream that will never die. Come there with me, come there with me. It's the whole of my own mind's eye.
So as a man who grew up in Belfast during the Troubles, where kind of normal life was interrupted quite a lot, recently you found yourselves in a position where you became the first band to play in Paris following the atrocities. Was it your intention when you decided to do it to show defiance and solidarity, or just to kind of crack on with things, really?
It was more just to crack on with things, to be honest with you. It was, you know, when we heard about what had happened, it was actually the second night of our tour. We were in Dublin, and we'd just come off stage, and we heard, and you know, like, as is always the way with these things, it's like rumour and counter-rumour, and we weren't sure how much of it was true, how much of it wasn't true, and it took a little while before somebody in the dressing room said, you know that Paris is like two shows from now for us. We're like, oh, didn't think of that. So, you know, our initial reaction was the same as everybody else's. We were just horrified and appalled by what had happened. It was a case of, well, we'll wait and see whether we can play. I mean, you know, we didn't know if we were going to be allowed to play, and the government put the that ban on public gatherings in place, and they declared 3 days of national mourning. And we were due to play on the Tuesday. I think the 3 days finished on the evening. But you know, by that stage, we were sat at a ferry port. We were sat at Dover. And we still didn't know whether we were going to get the go-ahead to be allowed to play. And in fact, our promoter called us while we were in the queue to get on the boat. And he said, yep, we're going to be able to do it. So, you know, we got on the boat. We didn't get to Paris until like 11 o'clock on the Monday night. We played on the Tuesday.
Yeah.
But it was very much a case of, you know, when I thought back over my life, you know, it was like, growing up in Belfast, one of the sort of the things that I was denied was bands coming to play. And, you know, that was just a given part of normal life for everybody else in the UK or in the world, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I felt, you know, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, we should play, just because the quicker Paris gets back to normal, the better it's going to be for everybody concerned. So that was very much our thinking behind doing it was, well, we'll go on. I mean, we didn't even make mention of the tragedy until, like, we'd finished the show, simply because, you know, we wanted it to be as normal a show as possible, you know, and not to make any capital at all out of what had happened. So that was our complete thinking behind it. It was just go in, play a normal show, leave.
Yeah. How was the gig? How was the kind of the, I suppose, the immediate kind of reaction from the crowd?
It was interesting so much as we happened to be in America at the time of the 9/11 attacks. In fact, we were due to play. We played New York the 8th and 9th of September and flew to the West Coast on the 10th. So we missed the attacks by day. We were due to play in Los Angeles on the 11th. And we played on the 12th. And the reaction from that crowd and from the Paris crowd were very, very similar. We basically walked on stage to a lot of people just shouting, thank you for coming, thank you for playing. And, you know, to have that happen twice in our career is, you know, kind of makes your blood run cold a bit, really. But it was, you know, that was about the only real difference. I mean, at the end of the show, I was just walking through the room and our merchandise guy called me over and said, oh, I was given a note to give to you, and it was from a young Lebanese woman who'd been in the crowd that night, and she was thanking us for our courage and for being there. And to be honest, that's kind of how I felt about the audience, because, you know, they were, for my money, they were being braver than we were by coming out, you know. So, you know, it, it's it was as much as humanly possible. It was a normal show. You know? But obviously, that you know what had happened was obviously at the back of your mind. You know.
Yeah. How did you find kind of the? Were you surprised by the reaction around the world then to your decision to play? I guess.
Well, you know, again, that was the one thing that lifted it out of the ordinary, because we honestly didn't see that coming. We really didn't. It was difficult to sort of do those interviews and try. I mean, eventually I ended up just turning them all down. Mm. I did like a few on the day of the show, but you know, for the follow the next two or three days, people were chasing us around Europe, wanting more to us to talk about it more, and we just didn't want to talk about it anymore because we'd done it. You know,
covered it. Yeah. I suppose, kind of putting a lighter note on it. Speaking of tours, I hear you once inadvertently turned down a tour with The Who. What happened there?
Basically, we were in a studio and Pete Townshend phoned up and asked to talk to somebody from the band, and I didn't believe it was Pete Townshend. Mm. So, you know, basically, you know, I picked up the phone and his voice said, "Can I speak to somebody from Stiff Little Fingers?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm with Stiff Little Fingers." And he said, "Oh, hi, this is Pete Townshend from The Who." And I said, "Actually, I'm joking, I'm the Pope," and put the phone down. And luckily he called back, and our manager took the call.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was basically they were about to do an American tour, and I think the deal was that he, Roger and John, each got to put forward a name as support act, and then they, between the three of them, decided which one they were going to take, and Pete wanted to put us forward. As it turned out, we couldn't do it anyway. We had other commitments in the UK at the same time. Mm. But yeah, initially it wasn't so much we turned it down. It was more I actually insulted him. But I did actually meet him quite a few years later and told him the story and by way of apologising. And he just fell about laughing and said, "You'd be amazed, it happens all the time."
When you have a famous name, I suppose it must be hard to kind of persuade people that you are who
you
say.
Yeah, I mean, I had visions of him having to get the wife to phone up every time he was ordering a pizza because they wouldn't deliver it because just that idiot thinks he's Pete Townshend again on the phone.
Yeah. Jake, thanks very much for talking to us, and good luck with the rest of the tour.
Not a problem. Yep. Thanks a lot.